From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
And welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo, sitting in for Carol Castiel. The late Fidel Castro was leader of a revolution that brought communism to Cuba in 1959, making it the first nation in the Western Hemisphere to embrace that economic and social system. He later went on to lead the island nation for nearly 50 years and became known for antagonizing its next-door neighbor, the United States, which broke off diplomatic relations in early 1961. Castro's dictatorial rule since taking power forced more than a million of his countrymen and women to flee Cuba over the years. And while Cubans mourned their late leader, it was reported that the community of Cuban exiles living in an area of Miami, Florida, known as Little Havana, took to the streets and celebrated Castro's death. Today on Press Conference USA, we'll take a look at Castro's legacy and the impact he and his government has had on the world and what might be expected in a post-Fidel Castro Cuba. And joining me in studio for today's program as co-host is Iscar Blanco. He is the chief of the Spanish branch, part of the Latin American division here at the Voice of America. Welcome, Iscar.
Oh, welcome to you, Rick.
Today, we'd like to welcome our guest, Alana Tumino, who is joining us by telephone from her office in New York City. Alana Tumino is a senior director of policy and head of the Cuba Working Group at America Society and Council of the Americas. She is also a senior editor of the policy journal America's Quarterly, a publication dedicated to politics, business, and culture in the Western Hemisphere with a focus on Latin America. Prior to joining America Society and Council of the Americas, Ms. Tumino worked with various international development organizations on microfinance and women's economic empowerment. Alana, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Rick. Happy to be here.
Thank you for joining us. When Fidel Castro died on Friday, November 25th, we saw tears of sorrow in Havana, Cuba, but yet in Little Havana in Miami, Florida, we saw celebrations. Why the parallel?
Well, you're exactly right. We have seen over the past few days and this past week a very heated debate about Fidel's legacy, and that's likely to continue for a long time. It's clear that he meant very different things for different people. As you mentioned, there was tears and mourning on one side of the Florida Straits and celebratory parades on the other in places like Little Havana and Miami. And, you know, on the one hand, you have a revolutionary hero who, for the first time, broke Cuba away from the United States. Admirers of Fidel also remark, of course, on Cuba's success story on health care and education and welfare. But he also, for many, represents an authoritarian leader who established a very strict regime that restricted freedoms and human rights for decades and presided over a state-run economic model that failed to bring prosperity to most Cubans. So it's very personal for many, especially for the exiles, the Cuban Americans in the United States and exiles who fled. But, you know, I think that it's going to continue for a long time. And what we're kind of focused on next is what comes next and what happens with Fidel's brother, Raul, who has actually been at the helm of power for about a decade now, what happens with the incoming administration.
If we could, Alana, could we step back a little bit so we can get some background on Fidel Castro's rise to power, the Cuban Revolution? What sparked this? What brought Castro to power?
Fidel came to power in Cuba because, you know, his revolution really embodied the ideas that Cuba was not an equal society for all of the people. He wanted to bring socialist ideals of equality against this imperial feeling of the United States ruling Cuba with the then leader that was in charge, Batista. And so the revolution and the revolutionaries that were by his side were really centered on this socialist ideology and communist and Marxist ideology of bringing that to Cuba. And at first, I think we saw that Fidel Castro and the group of revolutionaries really focused on empowering the people, and you saw that there was going to be, you know, potentially at first, a dedication to bringing that power to the people, potentially through a more democratic society. But we saw how that changed over the years, how power was consolidated, and how that played out, I think, you know, after 1959.
And I understand initially, as he rose to power, Castro did bring some positive changes to the daily lives of the common Cuban citizen, such as health care and so on. What did he do initially?
Absolutely. I think that Fidel Castro has many success stories in terms of bringing healthcare to the entire population, creating a population with extremely positive literacy rates, for example, high education, low mortality rates. I think, you know, Cuba is one, I think, in Latin America with the highest literacy rates at about 99.8%. So he brought a lot of the social welfare ideals. He made great strides in that with Cuba and really leveled the playing field, I think a lot of people might say. But at the same time, you know, there was a complete nationalization of the economy. There was the expropriation of businesses, and you had a number of Cubans who had to flee Cuba surrounding the revolution, and many who came to the United States and to Miami, given this new way forward with the island.
So how did his good intentions and his promises of democracy soon turn into a dictatorial regime that crushed any of its political opponents? What happened here?
I think throughout the past few decades, you can see that there's always been a huge emphasis on maintaining control within Cuba. And you saw that with Fidel Castro throughout the years. You even see it now, you know, even as Cuba is trying to open up. You see that the main goal is to maintain control over the economy, control over the population, so they don't lose control given all of these other influences, whether that's from the United States or around the world. So I think that by, you know, really trying to maintain that control, a lot of those promises went away, and you saw that transition over time from 1959 until now.
Let's talk about Fidel Castro's brother, Raul. Fidel Castro ruled Cuba for years and years. When did Fidel Castro leave power, and when did Raul take over?
So Raul took over for an ailing Fidel in 2006 and then officially became the president of Cuba in 2008. And since then, Raul has overseen a pretty ambitious economic reform program, precisely for what I mentioned before, because the Cuban economy, and lately we're even seeing this more in the past couple years, was struggling, and they needed to introduce a number of reforms, whether it was opening up their economy greater to foreign investment, to allowing for the formation of a private sector within Cuba, these small and medium enterprises within Cuba, and giving more support to that, and also decentralizing some areas of the economy, such as agriculture, to create more productivity. There was an understanding that Cuba's economy needed to grow. They had ambitious growth goals of, you know, growing the economy by 4%, by 5%, and so they needed to have this controlled opening to the international global economy, as well as within their own economy by opening to the private sector, to really try to meet those goals. We're seeing that this is even more acute now, even in this past year, with the situation with their relationship with Venezuela and how Venezuela had been a large benefactor for Cuba for a long time, and now that is changing, and there's more emphasis now for Cuba to open up to other countries and to diversify their economy and their relationships with different global powers to fill that void and to continue to hopefully make strides with their economic model.
Alana Iscar Blanco, people talk about the embargo, say that the embargo destroyed the economy of the island, but there are people in Miami who are support the embargo. So how is this? I mean, people talking about the embargo destroyed Cuba, but people in Miami say, no, we need the embargo.
I think the embargo was a vestige, I think, of the Cold War. It was a policy that was in place for decades. You know, from our point of view, the embargo and its policy goals didn't actually do its job of following through on those goals after decades and decades of trying to say, you know, economic sanctions are going to create the change that we want to see in Cuba from a U.S. perspective, and that just wasn't the case. The embargo ended up hurting the very people that it was supposed to support. And so there are very divergent views about the embargo, but I think on the United States side, there is now growing support that the embargo must be lifted so we can have not only greater normalization with Cuba, but that gives us an avenue to have more opening with the island, to have even more commercial relationships, to have more back and forth between Americans and Cuban Americans, and to have an opening that over time will not only create economic agency for many Cubans on the island, but will just create an opening that will be very hard to reverse, and that for Cuba as well will be very hard to control.
But help me to understand this. There is an embargo, but then through the years I see U.S. companies traveling to Cuba and do agriculture, a lot of things. So how's the embargo? Is there, but there are people who can do business with Cuba?
Absolutely. So the law of the embargo has to be removed by a majority of Congress, and that has been clear. But there are certain things that can be changed either by Congress or through executive action that we've been seeing lately that can poke holes in the embargo, and that can, under different regulatory changes from the Treasury Department and the Commerce Department, can create change. So most significantly, what we've seen in the past couple years from the Obama administration is a real easing of restrictions that is legally possible, even under the law, for a president to do under executive action. And that has been to create more commercial engagement between the two islands, to create avenues for more support for the Cuban people, to allow for greater remittances to flow between the U.S. and Cuba, to allow for greater people to travel from the U.S. to Cuba. And that has had a significant effect on the amount of money that's flowing into the island, on the amount of U.S. travelers and visitors who are going to the island. And that, in turn, has been impactful for the people of Cuba as well. You have a huge number of American visitors who are going to the island, who are staying in casas particulares, who are eating at paladares, who are really supporting this vibrant and small but growing private sector in Cuba. And also you have a huge amount of remittances that are going throughout the regulatory changes. We've seen an easing of the amount of money you're able to send to Cuba from remittances. And you know, it was estimated that anywhere between $2 and $4 billion in 2015 was entering the Cuban market, and a lot of that is for Cuban families. It is to finance these small businesses on the island. So through these executive openings that we've seen, the goal and the idea is to not only empower the Cuban people, but also create these different relationships between Cuba and the U.S. You mentioned the commercial relationship as well. That's been very important. We've seen companies from various sectors who have been able to go into Cuba because of these regulation changes. For example, telecommunications companies and travel companies and others who, because of the regulatory changes that happened under President Obama, can now enter that market.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow Carol Castiel on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or connect with us on Facebook by email to PCUSA@voanews.com, or simply like us on Facebook. And we'll be back with more of our program right after this.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
And welcome back to Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo, sitting in for Carol Castiel. My co-host for today's program is Iscar Blanco. He is chief of the Spanish branch at The Voice of America. And our guest is Alana Tumino, senior director of policy and head of the Cuba Working Group at America Society and Council of the Americas. Before we went to break, we were talking about the relationship business-wise with Cuba over the years, and in recent years specifically. But I want to delve into something a little more personal, and that is the cultural impact of Fidel Castro's rule and Cuban culture in general, not only in Cuba, but on the United States and the rest of the world. What kind of influence has Cuba had?
Well, for many in the United States, Cuba has always been this market, this country that has often been romanticized because it has been very off limits to the United States for travel, for business. And so it has really held a romanticized, I think, view in many people's minds. But what we've seen in terms of the cultural impact, really incredible artists seen in Cuba. You've seen great artists that have come out, great in terms of visual arts, in terms of performance art, the dance troupes that have been traveling around the world, and music group. The Cuban culture is very vibrant. It's very strong, and that has been exported throughout the world. And so many people who now are getting the chance to travel back to Cuba are really being able to experience this. And, you know, it packed when you're on the island, seeing these cultural performances, whether it's dance performances, whether it's going to the huge number of art galleries that are on the island, or it's going to see musical performances. That is a very strong component of what draws people to the island and what Cuba has exported over the years. When we go down, you know, our work is more catered to the business side, but when we go down with business delegations to the island from the United States, you know, there's always a hope that there's going to be some time on the side for these music performances and dance performances and visits with artists in their studios, because that's a really incredible part of Cuban culture.
Usually when we talk about Cuban exiles, we can't help but talk about Little Havana, Miami, Florida. Can you tell us a little bit about the Cuban diaspora in the United States? I mean, let's get a feel for the community that they have built here.
Yeah, there's a very vibrant community of Cuban exiles in the United States. Miami and Little Havana is where a lot of them ended up. It's interesting, a couple years ago, we actually went and did a study in Hialeah in Havana, which it feels like you are in, you know, just another city in Cuba. There's stores there that sell everything from school uniforms that you use for Cuban schools to filling pharmacy prescriptions for Cubans, for charging cell phones so you can call your family in Cuba. Cubans can come there and buy wholesale goods and products at these stores and then take it back to Cuba. There's just a huge amount of back and forth commerce between, you know, Little Havana and Cuba, as well as a huge Cuban-American community who are there. And, you know, it's interesting. It's a divided community, of course, in terms of who supports this kind of rapprochement and re-engagement with Cuba. But what we're seeing over time is that a majority of Cuban-Americans in the U.S. do support the process of U.S.-Cuban normalization, that they do support, would support a lifting of the embargo, and they have supported this reestablishment of diplomatic relations, but that it's also a generational gap as well. You have younger Cubans, you know, the sons and daughters of those that fled in the revolution, who don't feel as strongly, perhaps, as others in their family. So even sometimes families are divided over how they view this new U.S.-Cuba relationship. But we're seeing that there's more and more support for a closer U.S. Cuba relationship. We're even seeing that, as Iskar and I mentioned before, you know, you're seeing that even in terms of the embargo and more growing bipartisan support from Republicans and Democrats alike, you know, saying that we need to try a new path forward with Cuba, that over 50 years of the same policy didn't work to achieve our goals, so it's time to start a new path.
Rick, I would like to go a little back before Alana starts responding this about influence of Cuban music, Cuban food. There is a movie called Mambo King.
I remember that.
Yeah, that's the exactly picture of what happened when the influence of the music arrived in the United States. People left Cuba, they bring the instruments, they start playing in New Jersey, New York, Miami. So that gives you the sense how the music started getting into the United States. Mm-hmm. Then today, we have Celia Cruz. Celia Cruz was a big influence. Then we have Stefan, Gloria Stefan. Mm-hmm. In the movies, we have Andy Garcia. So Cuban influence started spreading across the United States and across the world. Going back to what Alana say about Miami, Hialeah, you don't believe it's a Cuban neighborhood, a complete Cuban neighborhood. I mean, don't try to live in Hialeah if you don't speak Spanish.
Okay.
I mean, that's it. Don't try to live in Hialeah if you are an American or a gringo and trying to say, hey, I want to live here. You need to learn Spanish. Actually, you need to learn Cuban Spanish. It's very picturesque. It's very nice going over there. And I'm half Cuban. So meeting my family in Hialeah is different than going to, let's say, downtown Miami.
Right.
It's totally different. Mm-hmm. Now, there is Calle Ocho. Calle Ocho is so fantastic that you see people playing domino on the street.
Right.
They have a domino parque. So people go over there, they drink the cafecito cubano, they play domino the whole day. They have a theater that they play Cuban movies. So going over there for one day as a tourist, it's very fascinating. The food is different than going to the beach. So the influence is big. Now, if you move to L.A., that's another kind of Cubans. And if you move to New Jersey, that's another kind of Cubans. But Miami has this sense of music culture, movie culture, like Alana say, galleries on the street. So it's fascinating. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, I agree. You know, when we were in Hialeah, it was my first time there a couple of years ago, and it really felt like you weren't in the United States anymore. It felt like you were in Cuba. And, you know, everyone was serving the Cuban market who was there, whether it was these stores, you know, as I mentioned, to buy school uniforms or get wholesale goods or to get your prescriptions filled, but also even in the auto shops, you know, they were making parts for cars, not for cars that are traveling on the streets of Miami, but for the cars, for the engines and the other auto needs for the cars in Havana and throughout Cuba. And there was a very, you know, the whole, it had all been worked out, you know, how the goods were going to be going from these different auto shops to the island and how they were going to be wrapping that and getting that in and out of the island. And it's a fascinating place to spend some time.
Believe it or not, I do have a personal recollection of Little Havana. When I was a youngster, well, 18, and so that's a few years ago, I had to travel from Sarasota, Florida, down to Miami to take my federal communications test for my first class radio telephone license. And one of the places we stopped on our way to the federal building in Miami was a little shop, a little tiny cafe in Little Havana. And the memories still flood back about how you can almost taste the culture, the Cuban culture. That was my first exposure to Cuban coffee. And that helped me with my test, too, by the way. But I just remember the people and just the overall feeling of the Cuban culture, that you can almost taste it, just in my brief time in Little Havana. Anyway, I'm curious about something that Iskar brought up. You mentioned Hialeah, you mentioned Little Havana, but you also mentioned Cubans in Los Angeles, New Jersey, and I'm sure other parts of the U.S. What's the difference?
I think, Alana, if you allow me, the difference is the sociological environment. People who move to places like New Jersey, Iowa, Seattle, they knew they never came back. They knew that they lost all relation with them, families. So they knew that they have to start more like the Italians. You know, it's different. You have to know that I'm living here. I never will back even to see my father again because Castro is there. So the whole revolution starts. So now I'm here. So the people in Miami have this 90 mile close to Cuba. So they believe that they are close. They believe that somebody's going to be in a raft. They have to run immediately and find that family member. And that happened a lot. I mean, if you're living in Miami, you're going to see that news every day. A raft is arriving, so people run to the beach, and people with flags and everything, and they are happy that some member, even if not your family, you're happy that some member is coming from there. So I think that the people in Miami are more romantic, are more sincere. I don't say that the New Jersey Cubans are not, but I remember my uncle, he lived in Texas. He was different. I mean, he was different than my mother. He was different than my other uncle, who played Celia Cruz every Sunday. He was more serious. He was reading more. He was more into the American culture. Of course, he drink cafe, and he drink all the things, and he drink ron cubano, but it was different until 5 years ago that he retired, and he decided to move to Miami. And the way he looks, the way he expressed himself, the way he behaved, I was thinking that he's going to move to another part of the town. He moved to Hialeah.
So he became engrossed in the
again
diaspora culture.
Again, yes.
So in other words, when you're talking about Miami, Hialeah versus the other communities in the U.S., it's more of the embrace of the original Cuban culture?
Yes, I think so.
Alana, any comments on that?
I think that's an interesting way to put it. And, you know, maybe Cuban Americans in New Jersey would disagree with you or from other places as well. But there is a real sense of connection when you're just 90 miles away, when you're in Miami, when you're in Little Havana. There's a real connection to the culture, to everyday life, to the cafes you're surrounded by, to the restaurants, to the culture, to the music. So I think that's a fair assessment.
Let's bring it back to the recent events. After multiple rounds of changes by President Obama to knit the two countries closer together, we have now a wild card that has emerged, and that's the election of Donald J. Trump, who has threatened to undermine the detente the two nations have been undergoing unless he can extract more concessions from the Castro government. Now, what do you think President Trump will do regarding U.S.-Cuba relations?
Well, I think this is a good question, and I think everybody's focused on this right now, what happens with the next U.S. administration in relation to this new policy towards Cuba. Legally, yes, Donald Trump could reverse the regulatory changes that we've taken towards Cuba because they've been done under executive action. So there is space legally to roll that back. Practically, I think that's going to be much more difficult. We are in a much different position now between the U.S. and Cuba than we were even 2 years ago. There are a number of actors who now have a stake in maintaining this process of engagement and continued normalization, and that's from a commercial perspective, from a political perspective, from a Cuban-American perspective, and a people-to-people perspective. And I think that, you know, in terms of our policy goals and what we want to see for the island from a U.S. standpoint, turning back things like increased travel and remittances, greater support for the Cuban people, and this commercial engagement hurts the people that sanctions aim to support. You know, so it's unclear what the incoming administration could do. We've heard, you know, that there's everything from putting Cuba back on the state sponsor of terrorist list to, you know, rolling back some of the regulations that are allowing U.S. businesses to operate there to limiting the amount of travel. But, you know, I think that, like I mentioned, this is a much different scenario than we were 2 years ago, and there are a lot more people who now have a stake in the continued normalization, making that more difficult.
Alana, I don't want to put you in the spot with this mm-hmm. question that I'm going to ask you, but in measuring time, when can we see a better Cuba? Because right now, with all these changes, there still feel no food, no civil rights. So in your idea, when mm-hmm. can we see this?
Well, I think we've been seeing a change in Cuba over the past few years as well. You know, first taking a look at what's been going on in Cuba in the past couple of years with this growing small business sector and the private sector, these cuentapropistas on the island who are now able to operate and do everything from opening their own restaurants to barber shops to nail salons to cafes to studios. And they have, you know, they've been given more legal space to operate these businesses. And with the increased amount of remittances from the U.S. and the travelers who are fueling the business for these companies, we're seeing that there's a lot more economic agency now for this population of Cubans who are small business owners, and hopefully that grows. We've seen a little bit of back and forth on the pulling back of regulations from the Cuban side over that sector, I think, in their wanting to control the sector as they grow as well. So, but we are seeing that more Cubans have more economic agency than they did before. We're also seeing in Cuba that Cubans are now able to access information and the internet more than before. There's a huge number of Wi-Fi hotspots throughout the island. When we were taking business delegations down to the island, it's pretty incredible to go by one of the Wi-Fi hotspots and see Cubans video chatting and getting online and talking with their relatives or family in Miami. And it was really neat to see this kind of connection that wasn't there before. So those kinds of things are changing as well. And also, you know, I was there during President Obama's visit last spring, and I think a lot of, you know, the people that I spoke with after that trip, there's a lot of expectation in Cuba right now. There's a lot of, you know, folks from the younger generation who now feel like they want to have a government that responds to them more, that they want to have a stake in their future, that they want to have more say. So there's a lot of, I think, hope, and there's a lot of expectation. But, you know, it remains to be seen how far that goes. Raul will step down from the presidency in 2018. So a lot of people are seeing, okay, so what comes after 2018? For the first time in 59 years, we won't have a Castro brother at the helm of power. You know, so who comes next? And I think that in that transition, there's a lot of speculation on, you know, there's a number of old guard revolutionaries who could potentially be in line for power, or you have the first vice president, Cuba's first vice president, Miguel Diaz-Canel. But you also, and then you have younger Castro's Raul son-in-law and Raul's son who potentially could be at the helm. But I think overall there's going to be an expectation, especially from younger generations, that they want to feel like there's the younger people who are going to be taking the reins and that their needs are going to be met more. And so, you know, and I think if we see Cuba continuing with this process of opening as they need to, because their economy is really not performing that well right now, so they need to continue opening to the international global economy. They need to continue to try to raise investment. So I think with the opening of their economy, and their need to open the economy, coupled with these expectations on the policy side, will create, you know, slowly a different scenario within Cuba. Nothing's going to happen overnight. You know, this is decades of the same kind of power structure, but I think we're going to continue to see change.
Alana Iskar, I hate to break this off since we're learning so much, but I'm afraid we're out of time. Alana Tumino is a Senior Director of Policy and Head of the Cuba Working Group at America Society and Council of the Americas. Alana, thank you so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to speak with both of you.
I'd also like to thank Iskar Blanco, Chief of VOA's Spanish Branch, for taking time out of his busy schedule to join us as co-host today. Thanks so much, Iskar.
Let's do it again.
Sounds good. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. I want to thank Anya Zaleski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Peter Hunley. I'm Rick Pantaleo, sitting in for Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.